Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great opportunity, this great privilege to sit back and relax and have a cup of coffee and hear a story. We get to hear the gospel in a new way, right? Because the gospel comes to us through the scripture itself, but also through seeing it lived out in the life of our brothers and sisters in the faith. And so tonight we're joined by Sam Guzman, former Baptist. He is the founder and editor of The Catholic Gentleman, the website, catholicgentleman.com, but also the author of the book, The Catholic Gentleman, Living Authentic Manhood Today, which is available from Ignatius. Sam, thanks for joining me today, joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I've been seeing your blog around the Catholic sphere for over the years, but it's great to finally have a chance to talk.
Yeah, it's great. I'm just really happy to be here. It's been 10 years of being a Catholic this past Easter, so just really happy to have the opportunity to share my story.
Awesome. Yeah, well, we're glad to have you here. So, again, we'll talk more about, I'd love to hear more about the website and the book later on. Yeah. We were talking a little beforehand, but we'll start going way back to the beginning. Where does your spiritual journey begin?
Well, I would say it started very early on in my mother's home. My parents were separated, but my mother really always spent a lot of time cultivating a spiritual atmosphere in the home. And very early on, she started teaching us things, not Catholic, but she would teach us a catechism from kind of a Presbyterian background. Just remember learning those, like, who made you? You know, God made me. Those very simple truths of the faith. And then she also had taught us some things. You know, what inspired her to do this, I'm not sure, but she taught us, like, the Te Deum, one of the most ancient hymns of the Catholic Church, which goes all the way back to St. Ambrose. But she taught us that, the lyrics. I had no idea what it meant. I just knew it was really beautiful and grand. And I remember reciting that. I was probably about 5 years old, you know, in the backseat of her car reciting that because she had taught it to us. But very early on, just this atmosphere of spirituality and devotion in the home. She would listen to sermons on tape and things. And so there was always this sense that the faith was something to be taken seriously. And she also taught us about things like, you know, the early church martyrs and things like that, that they really kind of planted a lot of those seeds of faith in my very young heart. Again, I didn't really always understand what everything meant, but I knew, again, that God was kind of this grand reality that wanted to be in relationship to us. And so very early on, I wanted to love God back, you know, I remember asking my mom, like, if I give the air a hug, like, is God there? Like, am I giving God a hug? You know, very simple faith, you know, but it started very early on. And I'm very grateful to my mother for instilling those things in us at a very early age. But I would say that's really where my spiritual journey began. And it's really kind of always been there as long as I can remember. I can't remember a time when I didn't believe in God or didn't believe in some spiritual reality.
So. Right. Was that coming from her background or was she sort of learning that and sharing it with you? You
know? Oh, yeah. It was very much a part of her life and very much she was very always kind of theologically minded and liked to read and study on her own. But also, you know, she played piano at church and things like that and was very much something that she was always learning about and then trying to pass that on to us kids.
And you said Presbyterian sort of background?
Really, she didn't really identify as anything specifically at that point. She kind of had some, you know, which kind of plays into my later journey, but she always kind of drew from different Protestant currents. And I think at the time we were going to a Lutheran church, interestingly enough, down the street. So kind of a lot of mix of currents there in her life, which meant that we kind of got a varied experience of faith as well.
We're speaking tonight to Sam Guzman, former Baptist and the founder and editor of The Catholic Gentleman. So, you know, a good Christian upbringing there, a lot of great roots, great seeds planted. Yeah. What happens next?
Yeah, so as I grew up, you know, my family was kind of a ministry family. My grandfather had founded a Christian radio network.
Neat.
So he was in kind of our small circle, he was someone kind of well known. And my mom was also a Christian radio talk show host for 20 some years. And so I was kind of grew up in this like ministry atmosphere where we're here to spread the faith, and we're here to help lead people to Christ. And that was kind of the atmosphere that we grew up in. However, as far as when it came to different churches that we went to and things like that, it was very mixed and varied. So sometimes we'd be in a Baptist church, sometimes we would be in a Lutheran church, sometimes we would be in a Assemblies of God church. You kind of didn't really know from Sunday to Sunday. Yeah. And so there was a really experienced a lot of different strains of Protestant Christianity, because there was just kind of the sense that we're non-denominational, if you will, right. You know, and every branch of Protestantism has something good about it or something to offer. And it also has, each branch has its own drawbacks, you know. So we're kind of hovering above all of that, if you will, and pick and choose what's most helpful to us. But we don't really identify with one branch of Christianity in general. So that was kind of the atmosphere that I grew up in. And I would say that my faith was really strong up until about eighth grade. And then I kind of went through this crisis of faith where I just kind of struggled a lot with scrupulosity. I remember when I was about 12 years old, I went through this real crisis where I was convinced, for various reasons, I'm not entirely sure why, but I was convinced that I was irredeemably lost. Like, I had committed the unpardonable sin, that I was essentially doomed. And was not one of the chosen, so to speak. I was hellbound, you know, and nothing I could do could change that. It was this sense of great despair, spiritually speaking. And and again, all the reasons for that, I don't entirely know, but I just know it was a very profound sense that, you know, we were singing hymns in church and about, you know, being saved, and I just remember thinking, that's great for all of you, but not, that doesn't apply to me. And so I just went through this real, like, profound, if you will, dark night of the soul, where I just really thought all was lost spiritually. Yeah. And it was a really painful time for me, actually. But I eventually kind of just gave up on Christianity in general at that stage, where I just thought, none of this applies to me. It's nice, again, for all of you who are saved, but for me, I'm essentially a reprobate sinner, and kind of walked away at that very young age. It's kind of very interesting to know how young I was, but how profound that spiritual experience was for me. And so going into high school, like a lot of teenagers, I wouldn't say I ever like became an atheist or anything, but I gave up on any practical devotion to God or religious belief whatsoever, and just kind of had fun and goofed off and did the things that teenagers do, you know, rebelled and all of that. But it wasn't, you know, I wasn't praying, I wasn't reading my Bible, I tuned out when it came to church, just kind of gritted my teeth and went through the motions, but really had no heart whatsoever for it. And so that lasted, you know, pretty much all through high school.
Yeah, I was thinking about how the different ways our faith comes to meet our human nature, right?
Yeah.
It seems like that is, at least in some ways, that's a common experience for people going through that, you know, young men and women. There's a time in our teens where that there's a crisis of scrupulosity and of this real question of, you know, what is my destiny? What is my fate? You know? And the question is, I mean, there's the question of whether or not we have a faith that can meet those questions that we naturally have as humans. But then even if we do, whether or not we've actually heard them, right? Because obviously we think the Catholic Church has an answer to that question in human nature, but many Catholic students miss it, you know, obviously.
Right, so, yes, yeah. Yeah, and interestingly enough, the scriptures just kind of were kind of dead to me at that point. Like I would try reading the passages that had inspired me and really just felt nothing. Yeah. Just felt no warmth or love of God or anything whatsoever. And that was, it was a very difficult time for me. You know, I didn't really open up about it to anybody. But there was a sense of, you know, and I don't know if a lot of teenagers experience this or not, but at least in my case, there was a sense of loss. Like, that was a really important part of my life that had just faded away. And it was kind of painful, even though I kind of buried it under activity and just goofing off and things like that. But it was a very difficult time for me. Yeah. So coming to kind of my senior year of high school is very interesting. I went through 3 years at one high school in Wisconsin. But then my senior year, my parents announced that we were moving to South Carolina. And I remember being really upset about that. My senior year was going to be my big year. You know, I had made some friends and, you know, it was really great. So I was really upset that we were moving away, you know, right before my senior year, and I'd have to start all over at a new school and a new state and make new friends. But then my thought was, well, you know, at least I'll go to the public school and there'll be all these like cool, fun kids to hang out with. You know, because I'd been Christian private school before. And, you know, I just thought, you know, I was just cramped you know, all these Christian chapel services and things that I don't want to go to. And I'll finally be free of that. I can go to the public school and just, you know, really sow my wild oats and just be free. But God kind of had other plans. I ended up, my stepdad ended up getting a job at Bob Jones University, their radio station. And if you're an employee at Bob Jones, you get free tuition at Bob Jones High School. Now, if anyone's unfamiliar with Bob Jones University, it's one of the most fundamentalist universities in the country, fundamentalist Baptist, very strict, you know, uniforms, lots of rules, you know, wear a tie to class, like very, very strict, much more strict than the school I had come from before. And my parents now announced that you're actually not going to the public school, you're going to Bob Jones Academy to finish your high school. And I was just irate. I mean, I was just furious that, you know, I had all these big plans for my senior year and they were ruined because I was going to this super strict fundamentalist Baptist high school now, which was not what I expected.
Yeah.
And we also started going to a church that I had no expectations for. I had kind of given up that Christianity had anything to say to me at this point. But it was a little Presbyterian church, an old Irish pastor. And that place really changed my life. The pastor was an unbelievable preacher with just a combination of scholarly knowledge, but also obviously a very warm and loving heart. And he could preach for an hour and 20 minutes and it would just fly by because he could extract more from a Bible verse than I had ever seen before. And it was really starting to go to that church and listen to that pastor's preaching that really started to reawaken faith in my heart. And I was like, if there's this much in the scriptures, then I need to start reading my Bible again. I need to start praying again. And I did. And I really rediscovered faith thanks to that pastor's ministry. Now, he was a Northern Irish Presbyterian who was very anti-Catholic. Mm-hmm. And I remember every Reformation Sunday, he would thunder against the evils of the Catholic Church. So he would probably be very upset to know that I eventually became Catholic. But regardless, I remain eternally grateful to him for reawakening the love of God in my heart and kind of reintroducing me to Christ as someone who I wanted to know for myself. And so that was a gift, and I am thankful for that. And also, Bob Jones Academy ended up not being quite as bad as I thought. I made some good friends, and it ended up being a good year, even though there were lots of rules and things like that. It ended up being a good year, and I ended up having a fine senior year. So it wasn't as devastating a disappointment as I thought it might be. But again, God was starting to work and starting to move. And I'm really starting to turn my life around at kind of that young age, 17 or 18. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful for those moments.
Yeah. Well, it's always, we always celebrate those moments, you know, even though obviously this on the show talking about conversion, the Catholic Church, we're part of so many stories, right? Are people who obviously found Christ, heard Christ, were introduced to Christ outside of the Catholic Church. Whenever that happens, the Holy Spirit's moving, and we're grateful for that. And we're grateful for the charism of many of our Protestant evangelical brothers and sisters, the charism that God has given them of preaching the gospel,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
Drawing people to Christ. I mean, that's powerful, and it's good. And so it's always great to hear it, you know, especially when that's part of a story here on the Journey Home program.
Yeah.
So what happens next there?
Kind of getting in, that kind of leads into my conversion, the beginnings of my conversion to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But before I get there, I do have to give some homage to my dear grandmother, who we had a very, very simple faith, just kind of a from backwoods of Missouri, and just had kind of a simple Bible-believing faith, you know. But she prayed for us kids constantly, and still does. And I really believe, you know, her prayers had a lot to do with me rediscovering faith, you know. And I remember going over to her house, and she would, you know, say, "Oh, I'm praying for you." You know, she's like, "Be a man of character." She would always say that, "Be a man of character," you know. And that really stuck with me. And I just want to say that I'm so thankful for her prayers and for her example. And I think it had a lot to do with me rediscovering any kind of life of faith at all. And I think there's always, you know, in our lives, and there's always those people kind of behind the scenes that their prayers and example have a lot to do. And who knows, maybe even in heaven we have, you know, ancestors praying for us or something that we don't know about.
Absolutely.
And all of that God knows, but I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, that great cloud of witnesses that we only get a tiny glimpse of now, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
God willing, someday we'll see the bigger picture of all those prayers.
Yes, yes. So what happened next was even more unexpected, but very profound in my conversion. And that was when I got a job on campus at Bob Jones University. So graduating from the high school was great, but most of my friends were going off to Bob Jones University, the undergraduate college of Bob Jones, and logically, I wanted to go as well. So I went, but to help pay for room and board, I wanted to get an on-campus job. Now, Bob Jones doesn't really let you leave campus. You can't go work at McDonald's down the street. They have lots of strict rules about when you can leave campus and when you can't, and there's a lot there. So it made more sense to get a job on campus. But where? They had an art gallery on campus. Now, I've always been drawn to beauty and aesthetics, and I've always loved art and great music and things like that. That was kind of also something that was nurtured in the home.
Yeah, you mentioned the Te Deum and some
Right. My mom was always introducing us to great literature, great art, great music.
Yeah.
And so that also planted a lot of seeds that would eventually bear fruit. But they had an art gallery on campus, and I thought, well, I like art. It's an easy job. You know, you just kind of stand there and say, "Don't touch the paintings," and things like that. So I ended up getting an on-campus job as a museum guard, you know. And so I started that job. But ironically, this Fundamentalist Baptist University that was very anti-Catholic, very anti, you know, everything liturgical, had millions of dollars worth of Catholic artwork going all the way back to like third century icons, all the way up to, you know, very contemporary but still very beautiful religious art. Mm-hmm. So they had works of the great masters, including Rembrandt and things like that, but they also had, you know, Catholic altar pieces. They had paintings like The Assumption of Mary into Heaven, or Mary Mediatrix of All Graces, where she's standing at the foot of the cross and kind of distributing the blood of Christ to the people. Yeah. And like, you know, just very, very Catholic artwork. And I remember standing there for hours, like there's little Latin inscriptions on a lot of these paintings and trying to translate the Latin and things like that. But just incredible outpouring of beauty. And, you know, I hadn't really seen any Baptist artists. I hadn't really encountered any great masters that happened to be fundamentalist Baptists. You know, tent preachers, you know, preaching some crusade or something. Sure. Yes. I've seen that, but I've never seen artwork produced at this level from anybody, in from a fundamentalist Baptist perspective. And so it really awoke something in my heart, like just stirred my heart. It's like, what did these people believe? I've been told that Catholics aren't even Christian. Mm-hmm. You know, my Presbyterian church, they're thundering away against the evils of Catholicism. And yet there's this outpouring of beauty. Like, what was the faith that these people had? What was the faith of the Christians before the Reformation happened, which was most of Christian history? What did they believe? And I had no preconceived ideas. I just knew that it was probably wrong, but I wanted to at least understand it. So I was like, I'm going to go back to the roots. I'm going to go back to the very beginning. And so I holed up in the Bob Jones University Library and I pulled off all the shelves, all the earliest Christian writers I could find, the earliest church fathers that I could find. So Irenaeus of Lyons, Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, a lot of these really, really early writers, many of whom actually knew the apostles directly. Right. You know, Clement of Rome is mentioned in the scriptures. You know, and I think it was it Polycarp was like a disciple of the apostle John, something like that. I might be getting that confused, but regardless, very, very early. And just started reading everything they had to say. And it sounded distinctly different than fundamentalist Baptist Christianity.
Right.
And I couldn't quite put my finger on why, but I knew it was a totally different way of talking about God, about Christianity, about Christ. There's mentions of these things like priests or presbyters, you know, they kept mentioning these. And I was like, what is this? You know, and deacons and bishops. And I thought, well, that's just kind of weird. I don't understand why they're talking about things like this. But there's got to be an explanation. Well, then a few weeks after I started this journey, I was in the Bob Jones bookstore. And they had a book in there. How this ended up in there, I don't know. Some other Catholic smuggler or something, I'm not sure. But they had a book called Four Witnesses.
Oh, dear.
By Rod Bennett.
Our good buddy Rod Bennett, yeah.
Yeah, and it was all about those early Christian apostolic church fathers and how their testimony bore witness to the Catholic faith. Now, I bought the book just because it had the names of the people I was reading at that time, but I had no idea it was actually a Catholic apologetics book.
Yeah.
Why would a Catholic apologetics book be in the Bob Jones University bookstore? It's very strange. But I started reading it, and at the conclusion where he kind of makes the case that that all of these early witnesses bore witness to the Catholic faith, I just kind of chuckled and was like, that nice try. But I was like, it did pique my interest that maybe there's something to this. Maybe they actually were Catholic. I still am not quite convinced.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting at least. But that really planted the seeds of kind of some further exploration that eventually led me to the Catholic Church.
Sure. And what had been, I was going to ask earlier, what had been your sense of history before this study of the history of Christianity? I mean, did you have, and even the term Protestant, I always wonder too at this point, did you think of yourself as a Protestant in relation to the Catholic Church, or was it much on the radar? And so was this history really like something completely new? Did you have a sense of the history that you were expecting versus the history you discovered?
Yeah, so my knowledge of the Catholic Church was always very limited. Mm-hmm. It was always the big bad enemy, if you will. So I remember when I was very young, my mom giving me books, like children's novels about the Huguenots are like these people in France who were persecuted by the Catholics. And in those novels, the Catholics were always the villains hunting the poor Protestants. And, you know, even in school, even in my Christian schools, the private schools that I went to, your American history was always tinged with, like, you know, the Spanish-American War. The Spanish were the bad guys. Or, you know, England and Spain were at war with each other. The Spanish Catholics were always the bad guys. You know, the Spanish were always like these Catholics who were greedy for gold, and they were just wicked and evil, and they were persecuting the poor Puritans and things like that. And so there was just a lot of villainizing of anyone who happened to be Catholic, not even in religious courses, but just even in American history. You never heard about, you know, the Spanish presence in California or in Texas or in Florida or any of those things in any other light than in a very negative light.
Right.
And so there was always just the sense the Catholics are the bad guys. Protestants are these heroes who are rebelling against this powerful, wicked church just filled with corruption. You know, then, of course, you learn about Martin Luther and how he battled, you know, the Catholic Church and his brave stand of conscience against the sale of indulgences and the 95 Theses. And there's just like a whole mythology that goes with a lot of these Protestant figures that there was is very hard to detach from and to see things objectively because, again, the Protestants were the heroes, the martyrs, the brave souls who stood up against this wicked, evil church. And so that was really about as much as I knew. Mm-hmm. I did always have this kind of fascination with saints and monks and medieval figures. I remember reading Redwall and the novels.
I love the Redwall books.
Yeah.
My kids read those all the time.
And the Abbey in there. And I just loved that. I just loved all of that. The idea of monasticism and friars, and like I had a lot of history books with pictures of medieval abbeys and monks and things like that, and I always found that all that so fascinating and attractive. But of course, like how do you fit that into a Protestant framework? You can't. So it became a kind of an aesthetic love of the beauty of all of that, but detached from the faith that gave birth to that. If that makes sense.
Well, let's take a quick break. And we'll pick that back up. You know, you're getting into some of the history and it's raising some questions, but there's a lot of baggage there. There's a lot of mythology, you know, that stands to be challenged. And so we'll see how that plays out. So, again, we're joined tonight by Sam Guzman, former Baptist, and we'll hear the rest of his story here in a little bit. He's the founder and editor of The Catholic Gentleman, the website, catholicgentleman.com, as well as the book, The Catholic Gentleman. So we'll pick up his story in a minute. I wanted to remind you, you know, if Sam's story has touched you and maybe aroused some questions or some movements in your heart, be sure to check out chnetwork.org. We've got over 1,000 episodes of the Journey Home program archived there, organized, tagged. You can find somebody who speaks to your particular story, as well as hundreds of written stories and short videos, all from people of a variety of different backgrounds who have discovered the Catholic Church and come home to the Catholic Church. I think you'd find their stories very interesting. So check that out at chnetwork.org. We'll pick it back up with Sam Guzman here in a minute. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. This is the second half of the hour here. We're speaking to Sam Guzman here tonight. He's a former Baptist. He's the founder and editor of The Catholic Gentleman, the website, catholicgentleman.com, as well as the book, The Catholic Gentleman, Living Authentic Manhood Today. So check those out. And when we left off, Sam, you were just talking, you were filling in the background a little bit of how you had seen the Catholic Church via your upbringing. You know, Catholics and Protestants and Christian history, you know, the sort of the idea that you had of it, as well as, again, some of the things that had inspired you, the beauty, you know. But then you begin reading the early church fathers, and it's at least bringing up some questions about, you know, about the picture of Christian history that you have and about the church. And so it wasn't enough to topple anything yet, but it's at least starting some new stirrings in your heart. So pick us back up there. What happens next?
Just thinking back, that time at Bob Jones was actually a very rich time for me. I remember reading a lot of C.S. Lewis and really just being reinforced in my Christian faith and belief through reading, books like Mere Christianity, of course, but also, The Four Loves, Surprised by Joy, a lot of his works that were really beautiful and very profound defenses of Christian faith and belief. But also, Bob Jones actually did have a lot of arts on campus, and I remember one time going to their choir's presentation of some of the works of Thomas Tallis, and there's this one, I'm getting chills just thinking of it, it's called Spem in Alium. It's a Latin work by Thomas Tallis, where the whole room was surrounded with choir, and you were in the center. And if you've never heard that piece, it is just absolutely mind-blowing polyphony. But again, it's all Latin.
Yeah.
Thomas Tallis was a recusant Catholic during the Reformation, and somehow ended up being a court musician for the, I think it was it the king or queen, whoever was the monarch at the time, and ended up being, staying Catholic and not getting his head lopped off somehow, but just produced this incredible, incredible music. And they performed that at Bob Jones. And again, just another like mind-blowingly beautiful experience I had that drew my heart to this ancient faith that was not Baptist. That's all I knew. But it was just this love of beauty that was drawing me on and leading me on down this path to the Catholic faith. Now, the next kind of stage on the journey was discovering liturgical Christianity. And there's a couple of things that happened there. First of all, I went to Barnes & Noble, a good old bookstore that pops up everywhere, and was just browsing the Christianity section. Because by this point, my faith was reawakened. I was definitely considering myself a devout Christian. Wasn't really sure what denomination I fit into, but didn't really matter. I loved God and loved reading my Bible and loved prayer and reading spiritual books. So I was browsing the Christianity section at Barnes & Noble, and two things I had discovered. One was, right next to each other, was the first English prayer book by Thomas Cranmer, but it was the first liturgical prayer book used by the Church of England. And right next to it was a book by G.K. Chesterton called Orthodoxy. And I had heard of Chesterton in some of my English classes in college. I was an English major. And I thought, well, I recognize the name. I'll just buy that book. And I also bought the first English prayer book. So the first English prayer book led me to Anglicanism. The prayers were very stately, dignified, beautiful. There was little, services in there for different events and occasions, including, a Sunday service, but also, there's like an evening prayer in there that a lay person could pray. But it was from the Psalms, and there were some very stately prayers that kind of accompanied that, and it was just very beautiful. And I remember thinking, this is really interesting, and that kind of led me on this path to explore Anglican or Episcopal Christianity. It was a very stately, beautiful expression of Christian liturgy. And so I thought, this is very fascinating, but I can't really go to an Episcopal church right now because I'm going to a Baptist Bible college. I had transferred to a Bible college in Wisconsin to save on room and board around this time. But I can't really go. My school requires me to go to a Baptist church, so I can't really go to an Episcopal church. I just kept feeling this attraction to liturgical Christianity, stained glass, Gothic architecture. I just found it all so fascinating and just created this ache in my heart for something more ancient and more rooted than kind of the Baptist altar call Christianity that I was experiencing Sunday after Sunday. And I needed something deeper, something richer, something more rooted and ancient. But I didn't quite know what that was, but I thought maybe Anglicanism is it. Then I also started reading Chesterton's Orthodoxy, which just knocked my socks off. I mean, just turned my world upside down. I was just electrified reading that book. Yes. Like, I had never read anyone from the early 20th century that was remotely interesting. You know, I had maybe read some essays from George Bernard Shaw in my English classes or, you know, some of those, but they were all just kind of dry and humdrum, and I just wasn't very compelled by them. But Chesterton, oh my goodness, his writing was just incredible. His paradoxes just blew my mind. You know, it just his way of seeing the world was unbelievably compelling to me. And lo and behold, Chesterton was also, for a lot of his life, an Anglican. And so I thought, well, there's something to this English Christianity thing. And so I just finally broke down and said, one of these Sundays, I'm going to slip off, escape from my Baptist church, and go to this beautiful little Episcopal church on the lake in Wisconsin. It was the most picturesque thing you've ever seen. Just beautiful little Gothic church with right on the lake. Beautiful gardens and everything. So I went in, beautiful service. I mean, the priest who was leading the service, it was actually quite a good sermon, and I was pleasantly surprised. I was kind of bracing myself for something a little bit liberal or wacky, but it ended up being quite good. And the service, it was everything I hoped for, just beautiful music. The liturgy was very stately, and the prayers were all in this, you know, kind of ornate English, and I just loved it. My beauty loving heart was like, this is it. Like, this is what I was looking for. So I tried to escape again another Sunday, and I bumped into another student from my Baptist Bible college who also wasn't supposed to be there, but who had also escaped to be there. And we ran into each other, and he said, hey, there's this Anglican seminary down the road. You should check it out. It's a really beautiful place. I'm thinking of enrolling there in the near future when I graduate. And so we both went back to school, you know, and we ran into each other in school. And we started having these discussions about liturgical Christianity and Anglicanism. And he was pretty much sold on it at that point. But I was like, I need to explore this. And around that time, I was feeling a call to ministry. I actually was seriously thinking about becoming a Baptist pastor. And I had done an internship at a Baptist church one summer as a youth minister. And I was kind of on that track and seriously thinking about going to seminary after I graduated from my undergraduate degree. But I slipped off to this seminary that my friend had told me about because they had services that were open to the public. And oh my goodness, I was in heaven. I mean, it's this beautiful seminary on the lake in the woods in Wisconsin. Just beautiful grounds, Gothic architecture. The chapel just smelled like incense, you know, stained glass, like beautiful hand-carved wood, everything. Beautiful, picturesque place. And I just started hanging out there. I'm like, I'm going to become an Anglican priest. Like, this is it. This is everything I'm looking for. It's that Reformation Christianity, but with all the beautiful trappings that I've always been drawn to. Just wonderful. Like, I'm going to be an Anglican priest. I found my home. This is what I'm looking for. I can have my cake and eat it too, so to speak. I can have my Protestant Christianity and my beautiful architecture and music and stained glass and liturgy and all of those things that I love. And so that really kind of was my introduction to liturgical Christianity in a more intense way. And I really was drawn to that.
We're speaking tonight to Sam Guzman, former Baptist and the founder and editor of The Catholic Gentleman. Yeah, so it's so interesting, again, whether or not our faith, we mentioned this earlier, whether or not our faith meets kind of our human nature, right?
Yes.
Like we have an experience of our, I mean, Lewis talks about this a lot, right? Mere Christianity.
Yes.
Like, I have desires, I have a sense of morality, I have an aesthetic sense in my human nature. And one of the questions, whether spoken or unspoken, is always whether or not my faith, whether its description of the world, whether its picture of the universe fits that.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, sometimes what we discover, right? When, there's a lot of great things in that Baptist altar call Christianity,
yes.
Right? But there's a part of that worship that's leaving something out.
Yes.
In my humanity. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I was really looking for a place where kind of that evangelical zeal and devotion could meet that beautiful aesthetics that I was drawn to. And I really thought Anglicanism was that place where I could bring those worlds together. But I for some reason, I hesitated on enrolling in that seminary. I got all the paperwork. I got all the pamphlets and brochures. I made friends with a lot of people on the campus. Very welcoming, warm place. But something held me back. And I think what really bothered me was, what is Anglicanism? Mm. I mean, you had maybe 30 different churches that all claimed to be Anglican, all believing very different things. You had the very high church Anglo-Catholics who believed in seven sacraments, would actually do things like Eucharistic adoration, would pray the rosary. Like, I mean, they were Catholic except for they didn't believe in the Pope.
Right.
And then you had the very low church Anglicans that were basically more like Baptists almost, where they would do baptism in the Lord's Supper, but they didn't really believe it was really the body and blood of Christ. It was just kind of the symbolic belief that a lot of Protestants have. They also, you know, had very like evangelical services with hymns, and it was just very low church. Yeah. And yet they all claimed to be Anglican. If you asked an Anglican to write a catechism, they would be incapable of doing it. Because other than believing that God exists, there's such a vast diversity of belief that they couldn't really agree on anything, even on the meaning of baptism or anything like that. And you find this in a lot of like Anglican churches, Anglican communions, or whatever you want to call it, where they have very loose statements of faith that are so broad and all-encompassing that they become almost meaningless. And that really started to eat at me, because it was like, look, there's this beauty, this lovely worship, this stately English, this great architecture, but there's no belief behind it. There's no concrete creed that you can cling to or embrace or say, I believe this. There's no credo, you know, there's no credo. And that really started to eat at me and really started to raise a lot of deeper questions like, okay, why, if we're so Catholic, like, why did the Reformation even happen? Like, why are we Reformation Christians at all? Why not go all the way back?
Yeah.
And right around that time, in God's providence, Pope Benedict decided to visit England. And I remember watching him sitting next to the Archbishop of Canterbury there in Westminster Abbey, which used to be a Catholic abbey and kind of got stolen by Henry VIII. But this beautiful Abbey Church, these two supposed leaders of Christianity, and I remember thinking, which one of these men represents the spiritual father that I'm looking for, the spiritual leader that I'm looking for? Which one represents that ancient faith that I'm longing for? Which one represents that solidity that I'm seeking? Where it brings all of these worlds together, all of these threads together. And I didn't understand it at the time. I still wasn't Catholic in any meaningful sense. But I just remember feeling this deep attraction to Pope Benedict and saying, that's the man, that's the spiritual father that I'm looking for. And that awoke in me for the very first time the desire to understand what Catholics had to say for themselves, what Catholics actually believed. What were the differences that led to the Reformation, and what did Catholics have to say about them? Not just what were the Protestant polemics against them, but what were the reasons for these differences? And that really launched me on a whole other journey of seeking and understanding.
Yeah, that's a really important question, right? You, the way you phrased it earlier was like, what is Anglicanism, right? Because there's two very different kinds of questions. There's one is, again, as we were talking about, that I have a love of Christ, and I have a, you know, and I'm seeking a worship that sort of fits my heart, right? So there's that part of it. But there's, to paraphrase Chesterton, right, I want a church that's not just right where I'm right,
yes,
but right where I'm wrong,
yes,
right? It needs to have some solidity that's outside of me,
yes,
you know. And so the question of what is Anglicanism, what is the Catholic Church as a body, as a thing, that's an important question that it kind of meets the other one.
Yes.
So yes, that's where absolutely. You were being led. Okay, so what happens?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Yeah, well, around that time, I just went headlong into kind of how I studied the early church fathers with a lot of intensity.
Yeah.
I went into this maybe 6 to 9 month period where I went headlong into studying what Catholics had to say for themselves. And so I got all the documents, you know, the Catechism of the Council of Trent. You know, I read the declarations and decrees of the Council of Trent. I got the Catechism of the Catholic Church and started reading the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And the more I read, the more I was like, this all kind of makes sense. Like, this isn't as weird and crazy and unbiblical as I thought. Like, there's actually a lot of good reasoning here in this. You know, and I still wrestled with a lot of things. I was getting no sleep. I was cranky and irritable, and I was engaged at the time. And my fiance was like, is there something wrong with you? Like, what's going on here? And I couldn't quite bring myself to tell her because she was very anti-Catholic. So this leads to a very painful chapter of my story, but there is a happy ending. But I was really agonizing over this and literally would lay awake at night with my brain just trying to digest all of this and understand all of it. But I read as much as I could of those documents and those differences and those explanations. Also discovered a lot of really wonderful Catholic apologetics through like Catholic Answers. But also there was a great website called Scripture Catholic. I don't know if it's still around or not. But basically what it does was it takes every Catholic belief and provides dozens and dozens of scriptures that back up those beliefs, which was what my Protestant mind and heart needed, is to know that, like, okay, this Catholic thing isn't unscriptural. And that site really helped prove that to me. Yeah. Of course, discovered Scott Hahn and all of his wonderful books, mm-hmm. Rome, Sweet Home, and things like that. Read many of those as I could. And really was feeling myself drawn further and further in. It was just like this magnetic pull. Like Justin said, the minute you stop fighting the church, you start being drawn to the church. And that was kind of where I was. I had stopped fighting the church, and I felt myself being gravitationally pulled in. And read Cardinal Newman. And I remember one of his writings that really made an impact on me was, he wrote this little short story about a young Anglican who converted to Catholicism and had to break the news to his mom. Well, my mom had played such an important part of my spiritual life that I was really dreading telling her that I was seriously considering becoming Catholic. And so that story kind of brought me a lot of comfort. But Cardinal Newman was another big English Anglican to Catholic convert that really played a role. And of course, Chesterton. You know, I was reading Chesterton all through this period, a lot, just dozens of his essays and books and things like that. And Chesterton had become Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that that might be the end of the road for me, was becoming Catholic. And I kind of, it was excited about that, but also kind of terrified by it at the same time because of the implications for that. I was working for a Protestant ministry at the time, a nonprofit, and thought, well, I might have to leave or might lose my job. And so just a lot of questions swirling, and it was a very difficult time.
We've got about 6 minutes left. So we know you become Catholic. You mentioned a tough time in your life. I'm presuming that had to do a little bit with those relationships.
Yes, the relationships that were important to me, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did, I got married, and was still struggling with this, and I thought, well, I'll just table it, maybe pick it up, you know, 6 months to a year from now. But then we were driving by a beautiful adobe Spanish-style Catholic church in Colorado Springs, where we were living at the time. And my brand new wife said, oh, what a beautiful church. And it was a Catholic church, of course. And I just, something in me just burst. And I was like, I can't hold it in any longer. I was like, yeah, it is a beautiful church. And by the way, I'm actually thinking about this Catholic thing. Like, maybe there's something to this. And that just launched us into a very painful, like, moment.
Were you guys Anglican, both?
We were going to an Anglican church at the time, yeah.
Yeah.
And she was very upset about that. And long story short, we ended up having a lot of heartfelt discussions about things. And I tried to answer as many of her questions as I could, but there were some moments where we were hanging by a thread, that first year. She did end up coming around. She real turning point for her was when Kimberly Hahn came to Colorado for a women's conference. Oh, wow. And I said, you know, you should really come. You should really consider going. You know, I might just want to check it out. And she went, and she was very skeptical, like thought the conference was terrible because they were singing hymns to Mary and things like that. But at the end, you know how popular the Hans are, but she said no one went up to talk to Kimberly. So she finally went up to talk to her and poured her heart out and about how upset she was about it all. And Kimberly was so kind and compassionate to her, and ended up, my wife ended up having her own conversion, which is a whole nother story. Yeah. But we ended up being confirmed at the same time in 2012, and are now Catholic together. So, yeah, God worked it all out. It wasn't and by any means something that she did against her will. It was something that she really learned to love and embrace for herself.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, and good on you for pressing on through that again. That taking that time to share with people and to receive, you know, their emotions. You know, when we share about this kind of spiritual journey, it can be rough, you know, but if we give people that space and we work with them, you know, Holy Spirit can continue to work. So I'm glad to hear that that was the result there. Maybe we'll have to have her on the show someday, hear her story as well. Well, we've got a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that we bring it to the present and some of the projects that you've been involved with, the website. Tell us about all that.
Yeah, so about a year after my conversion, I was a brand new father, and my search for something to kind of form me as a man, as a growing husband and father, really grew. And I was reading a really popular site around that time called The Art of Manliness, which has helped a lot of guys out learn some of those basic manly skills. And I remember thinking, well, there's got to be something in the Catholic Church for men that can really help a young millennial like me figure myself out. Yeah. And there definitely were. There were some men's ministries, but nothing that was really compelling enough for me to dive into, and nothing that was really offering me that formation that I was looking for. But I'll start a site. I was actually doing a prayer process, St. Maximilian Kolbe. I was preparing for a Marian consecration. And there's this like 9-day novena leading up to that. Of prayers, and it was about halfway through that I had this vision for this, like I could see the logo in my head, I could see the name, The Catholic Gentleman, and it's like, I'm going to start a site for Catholic men called The Catholic Gentleman. So I like quick got up from my chair where I was praying and ran over to the computer, just created a WordPress website and created a logo from clip art I found on the internet, and created a site called The Catholic Gentleman, wrote my first article. Had no idea what I was doing, had no plan, had no marketing strategy, nothing. Just created this site and just felt like it was an inspiration from the Blessed Virgin Mary, you know, and just started writing and started posting on Facebook, little graphics with saint quotes on them and black and white images. And it really just kind of took off and has been growing for the last 10 years, almost 10 years, 10 years yeah. next year. And really, really been a wonderful gift to, be able to grow as I write the site. Like a lot of the writings on the website came from my own growth, came from my own kind of insights as I grew as a man. And you can tell, you know, some of my early posts, I was a little more immature and saying things I didn't really know what I was talking about, but it was okay. It was like, it was all part of the process. And as I grew, the site grew, and it really has turned into something that I never expected. And that led to eventually the companion book, The Catholic Gentleman Living Authentic Manhood Today, which was another kind of unexpected blessing to be able to write that. But now I'm really focusing on the podcast. Nice. I have a co-host, John Heinen, and we're having a lot of great conversations with interesting people, but all towards this end of... The motto of the site is be a man, be a saint. So we start with that natural level of virtuous manhood.
Yeah.
But then we don't stop there. That is, you know, if you could fault the sites like Art of Manliness for one thing, it would be that they don't go further. They stop right. with virtuous natural manhood, but they never take it beyond. And that's what I try to do with The Catholic Gentleman, and say, yes, be a virtuous man, be disciplined, have skills, you know, learn how to provide for your family, but then go beyond that. Be a saint. Go from the natural level to the supernatural level. Yeah. From Benjamin Franklin and all that he can teach us about wisdom and at a practical level, but go beyond that to the saints, yeah, to faith, hope, and love. And that's what every man is called to. So that's really what I'm working on since for the past 10 years or so.
I love it. That's a really great and important mission. I encourage people to check out that website and your book and podcast. So thanks so much, Sam, for sharing your story. And thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Sam's story was an inspiration to you. We'll be back next week, as always, with more stories of how people have come home and to discover the truth, goodness, and beauty of the Catholic Church. We'll see you then. God bless.